me take this opportunity to welcome National Treasury officials present here. They have accompanied the FSB. As part of our program as a committee, we have decided to embark on this consultative meetings where we receive briefings from institutions that are aligned to National Treasury that, in a way, the committee has a direct responsibility, which is an intensification of how Parliament has been interacting with this kind of institution, apart from your normal annual plans, strategic plans, and all sorts of things that you normally present to the committee. We thought we should have a dynamic relationship and interaction so that we understand a little bit better what your activities are all about and how can we assist as Parliament to make sure that if you are a regulatory institution like yourself, how does Parliament ensure that you do succeed in executing your responsibilities? In terms of our invitation, particularly to yourself, we said we'll be coming to brief the committee on the role of the FSB in the financial industry, to the status and management of the private pensions, insurances, collective investment, financial advisory and intermediary services. Lastly, consumer education. We hope this is not too much, but also it is important for you to understand that we really take your role in the financial sector very, very seriously. Recent examples of what has happened in the world, the greatest part of the problems, of the challenges that we have in the economy, is as a result of either lack of over regulated industry. But I don't think in our case we've over regulated. Neither we do have mechanisms that we say are insufficient, but we think there's always room for improvement in this space. Welcome CD, the CEO of the FSB, and I call you CD, but CD to the CD, yeah. You'll introduce your team from your side, and we'll take it from there. Ours is to do more of the listening today, as we normally do, and then we'll then interact with you on what we think needs to happen. Thank you. Over to you.
Thank you, Chair, and honorable members of this committee for affording the FSB this opportunity to come and make presentation as requested by the committee through the chairperson. And I would like first to introduce my team chair. On my left here, I have Jonathan Dixon. On my right, immediate right, is Jürgen Boyd. Next to him is Jerry Anderson. Thank you. That is the team that I have brought with me today, Chair. And before I start here, as I said, I want to thank the committee for this opportunity. And for us at the FSB, coming to Parliament has never been something that worries us or something that causes pains to us, because we look at this committee as a committee that is there to guide us. Because, you know, it's always good to have a backup. You can never be complete on your own. You need to get advice from your seniors, and it's on that base that every time we come here, we cherish this moment, because we always go away with some ideas, some guidance, and we hope today we're going to have the same thing as we usually get. As per the request, Chair, we have an agenda there on the board. First, of course, we're going to look at the role of the FSB in the financial sector. Then we will look at the lessons learned from the financial crisis itself. We will look also at the initiatives that FSB is embarking on within the financial sector. And we will focus specifically on the insurance, investment institutions, retirement funds, and we'll also touch on financial advisory and intermediary services. We also want to engage the committee on this new concept of treating customers fairly. It's a new concept, but we want to embark on this one because we feel that there's a lot that can be done to transform the players within the financial sector so that they treat each other with respect and fairness. Then we look at financial inclusion. Under that, we will look at microinsurance, and we will also talk about enforcement as to what we do where players in the market do not conduct themselves in the manner that they should be conducting themselves. And then we will spend a considerable amount of time talking about consumer education and how best we can deal with it. And we will be open to suggestions. Thank you, Chair. Then I move on to the role of the FSB. The FSB was established in 1990. And the primary objective of establishing the FSB was to oversee the non-banking financial services industry in South Africa, purely to protect the interest of the public, in other words, the people of South Africa. And to do that, as per the mandate, we are out there to promote fair treatment, and this is where you've got the treating customers fairly come in. Fair treatment of consumers or financial services and the products must be fair. We also promote financial soundness of the financial institutions. We also promote systemic stability of the financial industry, and finally, integrity of the financial markets and institutions. That's what FSB exists for. How do we do that? We do that by regulating the following sectors, non-banking sectors of the financial sector. We regulate the insurance industry, collective investment schemes, that is the unit trust industry, capital markets, private retirement funds, and financial services providers under the FISE legislation. And the FSB conducts its work. How do we do this work? We perform this work by developing a proper regulatory framework. Of course, when we do this, we do it with the collaboration of the National Treasury, and of course, ultimately, if need be, through amendments to legislation, we come to this committee for that assistance, so that all the time we have our regulatory framework up to date. Then we do it through off-site reporting. These are all the statutory returns that the regulated entities have to submit to the FSB annually or as may be required by the FSB from time to time. Then we also do it through an on-site visit. And this is when we go out to the regulated entities to see what they're doing, how they're doing, are they complying with legislation, and if they've got any problems. On this exercise, if we discover some problems, the objective of this exercise is to assist those entities to rectify whatever it's a problem at that point in time. But however, from time to time, when we do our on-site visits, we do discover that some of the problems are just too big and too serious to be rectified immediately by the on-site visit team. When that happens, we immediately commission an inspection so that we go and interrogate the issues fully to find out what the real issues are behind the problems that we would have uncovered. And of course, once we've done our inspections or investigations, depending on what the contents of the inspection or the investigation report contains, very often there's regulatory action that is required. And where it is required, we take that regulatory action, and amongst them, including putting the institutions under curatorship, which simply means that we simply ask the management of that institution to recuse themselves so that the FSB, through the decisions of the court, take over that institution to assist to address the serious problems that are in the institution. But I know that very often people say, once an institution is put under curatorship, means the end of that institution. It is not always like that. The primary objective is to put the institution under curatorship, rectify what needs to be rectified, but at the same time, look at the people who are running that institution, whether they still fit and proper to continue running the institution. And if we discover that they are no longer fit and proper to run that institution, we will insist that new management gets appointed once the problems are resolved so that we get that institution back on its feet. I don't know if there will be questions on the curatorship. I intended dealing with the curatorship issues in total, but I will wait until when there are problems, Chair. For now, I will stop there and ask Jonathan to move on to the next slides. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Just a few comments on the lessons from the financial crisis. As the Chair pointed out, I think the financial crisis really has brought into the spotlight the importance of effective financial sector regulation and supervision. We also know that from the financial crisis that most of the problems developed in the banking sector, but that's not to mean that we from the Financial Services Board, who regulates the non-banking financial industry, that doesn't mean that we can't also take lessons from the financial crisis. There's been really a lot of thinking and talking about financial regulation over the past 2 years since the crisis, mostly through the G20, which is the grouping of the 20 most important economies economically, internationally, of which South Africa is one, a member of the G20, and also through a new entity that was set up called the Financial Stability Board. That's an international body that is really developing most of the policy recommendations on changes to financial sector regulation. And we, I must say, there's probably a paper every week coming out of the Financial Stability Board, so there's a lot of things to keep track of. But some of the key lessons coming out of the G20 and the FSB, by FSB I mean Financial Stability Board, it's a bit confusing, they're both FSBs, but probably the biggest lesson is that proper financial supervision is actually critical to both financial and economic stability. So one of the lessons from the crisis was it was actually those countries that perhaps had the better regulation. And examples that are usually used include Canada and Australia, and in fact South Africa as well, were the countries that were least impacted by the financial crisis. Whereas those countries where financial regulation had a lot of gaps or was a bit problematic, and the prime example here is the United States, suffered the most from the financial crisis. So from an economic growth, stability, and development perspective, I think a key lesson is that you need to make sure your financial sector remains stable, because if you have financial volatility or instability, it really has very dramatic effects on economic growth if things go wrong. Some of the other key lessons from the crisis, just to go through quickly, one was a new focus on system-wide supervision, which means that financial regulation should cover all important aspects of the financial sector. So, for instance, there were some previously unregulated entities like hedge funds, which people are saying should now be included under financial regulation. An example of where problems like this developed was the only major case of a failure of an insurance company was AIG, which was the world's largest insurance company. And it failed not because of problems with its insurance business, but because of a problem in a very small subsidiary based in London that was doing financial guarantee business, which was largely unregulated. And that caused the collapse of the whole AIG group. And that's an example of why there's now a new focus on supervising all aspects of the financial sector. It's also an example of the next bullet point there, a new focus on conglomerate supervision. And that's come about because of a realization that the financial sector, the industry has developed in such a way that the more and more you're seeing large groups or conglomerate groups, which include banks, insurance, collective investment schemes, hedge funds, all within one large international group. And it's been realized that regulation generally internationally has not kept pace with these industry developments. So most of regulation and supervision focused on each little part of the group, but nobody was looking at the group as a whole. So now supervision is in South Africa, but also internationally, trying to develop a picture of a whole group. The next bullet there, there's also a new focus on what is called macroprudential regulation. And that's opposed to microprudential regulation, which is microprudential regulation is when you focus on a single company, whereas macroprudential regulation is all about realizing that the financial soundness of one particular financial entity can have a spillover effect on the entire financial system. So now the focus is on the financial system as a whole and any threats to or risks to the stability of the sector as a whole. That includes things like a more intensive focus on what are called systemically significant financial institutions. So those would tend to be the very large financial entities in an economy. So, for example, if we take the South African case, the Standard Bank Liberty Life Group would tend to be a systemically significant entity, because if there was a failure in that group, that would have very serious consequences for the entire financial sector. It also means a new focus on, like I said, macroprudential surveillance and tools. In other words, trying to pick up early warning signs of risks or vulnerabilities in the system, and trying to think through ways to manage those risks. And lastly, looking at anti-cyclical capital requirements, because there was a realization from the last crisis that sometimes when the economy starts to go down, that triggers things in regulation around regulatory capital, for instance, that can actually make the economic cycle worse. So there's some focus on trying to build in automatic stabilizers into the regulatory system as well. And then lastly, the other last key lesson is about the importance of supervisory coordination. And if we take, again, the U.S. as an extreme example of how not to do supervision, there you have each of the 52 states in the U.S. has its own insurance supervisor. And there's separate regulators for insurance, for banks, for small banks, for securities, a whole myriad of regulators. And it was apparent that they didn't do a very good job of talking to each other. So the key lesson is that supervisors must make sure they talk to each other and coordinate. And this is where this idea of what's called the supervisory college, which is really where regulators and supervisors come together to talk to each other about a particular entity or risks in the sector, comes from, and also the idea of peer reviews, that supervisors will, going forward, be subject to periodical reviews of how effective they are. So these are some of the key lessons from the crisis, and these are all getting attention within South Africa, and the FSB is paying attention to these issues as well. And there were also issues that were picked up as part of the recent IMF and World Bank financial sector assessment program that we went through earlier this year. And then if I go on to the next few slides are really looking at each sector that the FSB regulates. The first one on the agenda is the insurance sector. Firstly, just a quick slide to give an update on the status of the sector. First point is that there was limited, if hardly any, direct fallout from the financial crisis. There were no failures of insurers in South Africa due to the financial crisis. So the insurance sector in South Africa really came through the international financial crisis very well. Much of that was because we entered the financial crisis with the capital levels of the insurers being quite high, due to the fact that there was a long period of growth and stock market growth as well prior to the crisis. So they went in with healthy capital buffers. Things obviously deteriorated in the crisis. Fortunately, now with the recovery in the JSE and other asset markets, the financial position of insurers has generally improved quite considerably. But there has been some indirect impact, because obviously with the economic slowdown following the crisis, this has meant lower sales for insurers and increased lapses and surrenders. In other words, more people terminating their policies, which also has a cost for insurers. But you'll see from the graph there, the top blue line is the overall result of the insurers, and you can see from the shape of the graph that things have been, have been on a downward track, but still around medium in terms of the long-term trend. And underwriting results have actually remained, which is the pink line, remain relatively stable through the crisis. The one thing we are seeing with the economic slowdown is that there is an increased number of smaller insurers who are experiencing some financial strain, which means that we, as the supervisor, just have to spend extra effort monitoring those situations quite closely. The next slide then just talks a little bit about some of the initiatives that we're busy with on the, from the FSB side in the insurance sector. Many of these talk to the lessons from the financial crisis. The first bullet there is I think the term that the committee may hear a lot about over the next few years, which is the solvency assessment and management framework that we're introducing, or SAM for short. And this is really about responding again to the IMF World Bank recommendations and about making sure that the solvency regime, or the regime for looking at the financial soundness of insurers, remains on track with international standards and best practice. And it's really, members will remember a few years back there was the introduction of Basel II for banks, which was about moving to a risk-based approach to regulation and supervision. And the equivalent internationally of Basel II is called Solvency II, which they are introducing in Europe. And SAM is about introducing something that's equivalent to Solvency II, but adapted as needed for South African circumstances. And it covers the technical aspects about financial requirements, but it also looks at important governance and risk management issues as well. And the targeted implementation date for SAM is January 2014, which sounds a long way off, but there is quite a lot that needs to be done in the next 3 years to meet that target. But how we're managing the project from the FSB side is to make sure it's a very inclusive project, including involving industry and other stakeholders like the National Treasury and the South African Institute of Chartered Accountants and SARS and a number of other stakeholders. And that's a major project for us over the next 3 years. The other big project is looking at insurance group supervision. So that ties back to the point about looking at supervising conglomerates. And in order to do that, we just need to put in place some legislative provisions, which we hope to come to the committee on next year. And it also includes reporting requirements and importantly, supervisory coordination. So we are working more and more closely with the bank supervision department in the SARB. The third bullet there has a lot of focus at the moment is conduct of business, how insurers are conducting their business. And at the moment, a particular focus is on when insurers outsource their certain functions to third parties. We are just making sure that when they outsource, they don't lose sight of the fact that the insurer, who is the license holder, remains accountable to the regulator, and that they must then exercise the proper oversight over the parties that they have outsourced functions to. And the particular issue we're looking at the moment is what are called binder agreements, which enables a third party to do some underwriting on behalf of the insurer, and we're busy finalizing some regulations there, which we hope to table in this committee before the end of the year. Just the last major focus is the issue of microinsurance, but we have a slide on that later in the presentation.
Thank you, Chair. I'm now going to ask Jack and Boyd deal with the retirement fund issues. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Chair. Before I deal with pension fund surplus apportionment, which is my first bullet point, if the committee will just allow me, I just want to touch briefly on the financial crisis and the impact on the pension fund sector that we regulate and supervise in South Africa. Because of the long-term nature of pension funds, the crisis as it unfolded in late 2008 onwards, the pension fund sector was largely not affected, and the main reasons behind that was because of the requirements of exchange control on the one end, where there was obviously a limit on what pension funds as institutional investors could invest offshore, as well as our investment spreading requirements contained in Regulation 28, which limited pension funds' investment in the type of toxic products that caused many of the issues that led to the financial crisis. So we were very much protected with regard to because of those two controls we had in place. However, as we no doubt know, there's been significant job losses as a result of the crisis, in some figures in excess of 1 million job losses, and that would have led to quite a number of withdrawals out of the pension fund industry, because people obviously are losing their jobs, need something to survive on, and the first thing they would go to is their pension fund savings. And unfortunately, those individuals who had actually exited and withdrawn their pension benefits as a result of job losses would have kind of suffered a double whammy. Because during that period, we all no doubt know that equities market took quite a knock, and they would have withdrawn from the pension funds when equities markets were fairly on a downward trend. So it would have been particularly bad for them. And that was the unfortunate consequence of withdrawing at that point in time, because as you no doubt know, we don't have preservation as it exists in our pension fund system. So that's just broadly an overview of the impact of the crisis on our pension system. Coming to pension fund surplus apportionment, it was as a result of legislation that was passed, the apportionment legislation passed in 2001. As at the end of July 2010, we have had just under 8,000 apportionment schemes and nil returns that have been submitted to the FSB, out of what we estimate a total of 8,500. So there's about 1,000, or between 1,500 and 2,000 left that we estimate still need to be submitted. Of these 7,984 schemes submitted, we've approved just over 7,000. Of that 7,000 we've approved and no scheme noted, the stats below indicate that 1,000 of them would have been standalone funds, 500 would be out of umbrella fund structures. Those apportionment schemes that we actually approved, and schemes that were submitted that actually had showed nil returns, in other words, no surplus to apportion, were about 6,500 standalone funds and 12,500 umbrella funds. Just a note for the umbrella funds: each participating employer needs to submit a scheme, and so we still got a number of them that we're expecting to be submitted. Total value of surplus apportionment schemes that we've approved to date was just under 19 billion. Could we move to the next slide? Just to touch on a couple of initiatives that we're embarking on at the FSB with regard to retirement funds. Not a long list, because we are obviously waiting for the whole pension fund reform process to unfold, because that will determine the long-term future of how we go with regard to pension fund regulation and supervision. With regard to trustees, we estimate there's probably between 30 and 50,000 trustees in the existing operational 7,000 pension funds that we have at the moment. It's quite a significant number. And A big issue with regard to that large constituency is the level of governance, where we have come across problems with pension funds largely as a result of governance. As a result of that, we in 2007 issued a guidance note called PF130, which kind of set to all the industry and trustees specifically the ideas that should be taken into account on boards of trustees with regard to governance of pension funds. Our intention is to actually align that PF130 firstly with the King III Code, and once that's done, we're going to convert it, in fact, into a directive, in which case it's going to become mandatory. At the moment, it's a voluntary it's voluntary compliance required, but once we convert it to subordinate legislation, to a directive, it's going to become a mandatory requirement for pension funds to comply with. The next initiative is around trustee training. As I indicated, there's a large trustee body out there. There's a requirement of pension funds to have 50% be represented 50% by members and at the board of trustees, and 50% by an employer. And a big issue we found around governance as well is issue around how well skilled this large body of trustees are. For us to embark on trustee training per se of 30 to 50,000 trustees would come at enormous cost. So we play largely a facilitatory role in with regard to trustee training. Initiative we've got on the go, and Jerry will touch on it later on, in conjunction with our consumer education department, is a trustee training toolkit which we're going to develop. We've borrowed this from our fellow regulators, the UK pensions regulator, and they've got a very similar pension system with also a large trustee constituency with similar type of problems, and they've introduced it 5 or 6 years ago, and we're kind of stealing the idea from them. We've sent a team to visit with them late last year to discuss issues around how they set up this training toolkit, and we've just gone out on tender for service providers in South Africa to tender to develop our toolkit. But essentially, how this will work is each individual would go onto the web and go through different modules, but about the learning and testing, and there'll be self-testing, and at the end of it, for each module, there'll be certification. We think it will be a very cost-effective way of reaching the wide body of trustees we have out there. Our intention is to implement this by mid-year next year, and the cost of this whole exercise is being funded by our Consumer Education Foundation. Okay, my colleague, Mr. Bert Janetta, is not here, and I've kindly agreed to talk on EZRF. He deals with investment institutions and capital markets, just to touch on the initiatives that we're involved with there. Firstly, on the unit trust or collective investment schemes industry, this industry is extremely well regulated. Despite our crisis that we went through, it's an industry that continued to get inflows during and after the crisis, so it's functioning quite well. However, there are a couple of issues in the industry that my colleagues are looking at. The one is specifically with regard to white label funds. That's where CIS, or Collective Investment Scheme Manager, in fact, uses his license to allow other parties to set up funds under his license, and it's kind of, we call it a white label fund, and there are issues around that they're trying to address. The second issue is around what is called black box products. I think he described it as when a giraffe goes through the door and an elephant comes out on the other side. That's where products are crafted and marketed on a specific basis, but what comes up in the other end is totally different to that. And the way the product changes from the one to the other is creating issues for my colleagues. So they're looking at those specific areas, and they're going to, as well as some other types of investment under their regulatory notice 153. Leading from the issues around the financial crisis, G20 discussions, FSB, the Financial Stability Board discussions and guidance, as well as IOSCO, hedge fund regulation, over-the-counter derivatives and credit rating agencies are on the table for discussion at the moment. So with regard to hedge fund regulation, there's a joint National Treasury FSB working group looking at developing a regulatory platform for these type of products based on the guidance coming from the international organization IOSCO, as well as the FSB G20 discussions. Over-the-counter derivatives, there's been a push by the industry to allow these as investment products. Again, coming from IOSCO and some of the international organizations, there's a bit of conservativeness and hesitancy about these products. So we're also looking at a work group looking from between National Treasury and industry to look at the need, should we or should we not regulate these type of products, and which of these should we regulate. Credit rating agencies, we all know that now took a big hammering leading up to and during the crisis. There were serious issues concerning credit rating agencies, so the FSB together with National Treasury again are looking at how do we regulate these agencies and to what extent we'll extend that regulation. On the next item on these discussions as we speak on the JSE Visa merger, that which has been concluded, it seems to be working fine. We've, from our perspective, had major input into those discussions. There's been some JSE trading failures in the last short while. Two significant failures that took place led to the market closing. The issues around what caused those failures have been identified and are being addressed as we speak now. And significantly, IOSCO conference is like the past World Cup that we've hosted here. This is the World Cup of securities regulators. It's quite a privilege to be awarded the opportunity to host the IOSCO conference, and we're holding it next year for the first time in Africa and the first time in South Africa in April next year here in Cape Town. I guess the members who are interested will be welcome to join us in that conference.
Jerry?
Thank you, Chair. I'm now going to ask Jerry Anderson to give a presentation on market abuse. And later on, the same Jerry will also give a presentation on market conduct. This is now abuse. Conduct will come later. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Members, in terms of the Securities Services Act, under which the JSE is regulated and stockbrokers that fall under the JSE, etc., provision is made for the FSB taking charge of prevention of market abuse. To do this, the committee of the board in terms of the act has been established, and the Market Abuse Directorate looks at issues such as insider trading. Members may be aware, Chair, that previously we had quite a state-of-the-art standalone Insider Trading Act, which was passed by Parliament in 1999, I believe, 1998, 1999, but it was absorbed into the Securities Services Act that came into force 2003-2004. With the advent of this act, we increased our surveillance over insider trading to include other issues such as market or price manipulation, publication of false or misleading statements relating to listed companies, because we realized that if you want to have a market that is effective and has integrity, you have to expose these issues. And prior to the Insider Trading Act, there was a big perception, it may have been how real it was, we don't know, that there were a bunch of cowboys in Diagonal Street in Johannesburg. They've now moved since, and we believe the situation has changed greatly. During the financial crisis, the number of market manipulation cases linked to single stock futures increased. We should be aware, Chair, Vox is one of them. Seeing in the newspapers this morning, Pinnacle Point, Arcross shares, Nedbank's involvement was also part of this single stock futures fallout. DealStream, which is a company that was placed by the FSB under curatorship and eventually into liquidation, was also a single stock future example or caused by. Inside a trading crisis, funnily enough, our statistics show decreased during the market crisis, but they've now come back with the market being more stable. And then the graph reflects the number of cases that, in the beginning we started with only insider trading, but just reported cases or detected and reported cases. We can see that prior to 1999, as I indicated, we didn't know what was the situation, but there were a number of cases we picked up after legislation to combat this came into force, and then the figures have got a slow downward trend over the years until now. The reason I look to what my mirror reflects in the morning's chair is because of FAS. FICE has been around for 5 years, and I've probably aged 10 years during those 5 years. FICE is a volume challenge, Chair. The volume challenge...
You realize only
the volume challenge because of the 13,000 to 14,000 licensees. I'll get into the statistics a bit later, which incorporates something like 5,000 sole proprietors, brokers in outlying areas, 12,000 odd key individuals, people that are in supervisory positions in these in the licensed entities, the financial services providers, and more importantly, something like 130,000 to 140,000 representatives that fall under this legislative framework and that are generally the folk that interact with members of the public. Currently would be the end of July, we had 12,911 licensed financial services providers, valid licenses. This number, Chair, has gone down from about a peak of 14,800 some 2 years ago. Approximately half of the decrease can be attributed to the recent financial crisis. People or licensees leaving the industry. There are other reasons why the numbers have gone down as well, but if where, just to refer back to the crisis and its impact. Since the Act came into operation on 30 September 2004, but we started evaluating applications for licenses as early as late 2003, and we've processed up to date 20,252 applications, of which nearly 1,900 have been declined. They don't meet the requirements, either ability to operate, but more importantly, fit and proper criteria, which can include integrity and honesty issues, and also experience, minimum qualifications, and the like. There are currently 857 licensees under suspension. Under suspension means that there are rectifiable contraventions that are out there. So you get suspended if the contravention is rectifiable. For instance, non-submission of financial statement, annual financial statements, or compliance reports. 487 have been withdrawn. These are more serious. These could be anything relating, Mr. Chidi spoke about enforcement and inspection, sending inspection team in and they find very serious contraventions, probably bordering on fraud, theft, etc., then one of the regulatory actions that would ensue would be withdrawal. Two of the registrar's decisions are in the appeal process. There are others, but these two have been allowed to continue with their business until such time as the final appeal takes place. And then voluntary lapses over the 5.5 years amounts to 3,842, with another 260-odd in process. Two initiatives that I'd like to touch on in the regulatory framework of FIRES are the regulatory exams. Now, the FIRES Act has two objectives. The first being consumer protection, but secondly, also uplifting or professionalizing the people involved in dealing with the clients for the financial products that FIRES covers. Part of this professionalization, which is an ongoing thing, and we've used the building block approach because you couldn't introduce requirements that had to be met at one go. So it's been introduced over time. Is the recent introduction of regulatory examinations, or what we call regulatory examinations. The reason for these regulatory examinations is that coming into operation of the FIRES Act, we have increasingly observed that the people, entities, whether sole proprietors or big broking groups or even life companies to a smaller extent, have little or no knowledge of the regulation that governs them. And for that reason, we said, we thought about this and we considered it carefully and we said we need to introduce some type of requirement that makes you aware of what you are required to do if you hold a FIRES license. We are busy rolling out these regulatory exams. They number 24 in total. Each will be piloted. The questions will be evaluated. The results will be evaluated just to determine whether the examination questions are at the right level, whether they are clear to the people that have to take the examination. And then there are two. The one, the level one is the general FICE landscape, whereas the level two regulatory exam, which will have to be written by representatives, and you will recall, Chair, I mentioned there's something like 130,000+, will focus on the different financial products. Secondly, Chair, another initiative that has been probably reported widely in different media is the conflicts of interest that have been introduced recently. Now, this code on conflicts of interest is an extension of the general code of conduct which every licensee or financial service provider has to comply with. In that 2003, which is subordinate legislation, in that 2003, the first code, there was a straight line saying you must put your customers, clients' interests first and you must avoid conflicts of interest. I can talk a lot about examples of conflicts of interest, but just safe to say that we had maybe 13,000, 14,000 licensees and 14,000 interpretations on what does avoid conflict of interest mean. So instead of a principle-based approach, avoid conflicts of interest, we had to introduce sort of rule-based approach, and this introduction or publication of the subordinate legislation extension was published in April 2010, is introduced different requirements introduced over or come into force over a 12-month period from then, 19th of April 2010, and spelled out to a great extent what we mean by conflict of interest. Ownership issues, target issues. Does a bank, for instance, tell its brokers force, listen, we are allied to this insurance company, so you have to sell of all the products you supply, you have to sell 80% of that insurance company. All that conflict of interest, because then the client at the end of the day doesn't get freedom of choice, doesn't get the best product that's available. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. We're now going to go back to Jonathan Dixon to lead the committee with regard to the treating customers fairly presentation. Jonathan, thank you.
Thank you, Chair. The Treating Customers Fairly Initiative, or TCF for short, is probably one of the biggest initiatives that the FSB is embarking on at the moment, and probably, I guess, touches the lives of the general public out there and constituents. The most, in that it really is a campaign to try and make sure that financial sector companies treat their customers fairly. This has arisen, well, let me firstly say, this is something, again, that we've, in a sense, borrowed from international best practice. This is something that was developed in the UK by the Financial Services Authority in the UK, but we hope to adapt to South African circumstances. But the very same reasons why the UK FSA developed this approach apply here, which really is that, you know, the situation is that we do have some quite extensive laws and regulations dealing with how financial services companies should go about treating their customers and conduct their business. But despite all these rules and regulations, we still find a situation where there's still far more or too many cases whereby consumers are either being treated unfairly or being abused or overcharged or not being advised in the best way or not being treated in the best way. You know, and we've seen over time, over the last few years, various cases, and most of the cases you'll read about, you know, Bruce Cameron will write about them in Personal Finance and they appear in the media. And the question comes about, well, why are we still having cases of customers being treated unfairly when there are these rules and regulations? I think some of it comes down to the fact that as long as there's rules and regulations, there will always be the temptation for financial services companies to spend a lot of money on clever lawyers to find the loopholes in the rules and regulations. So the question comes back to, well, what do we actually need to do, and what we think actually needs to happen is that there needs to be a fundamental change in the culture and the attitude and the behavior of financial services firms. So from the top, from the board of directors downwards, a new attitude to how financial services companies treat their customers. So no longer just an attitude of, well, let's see how we can comply, how we can get around complying with the legislation, but more about internalizing the issues of treating customers fairly and making sure that in every aspect of how the business conducts itself, that it is treating customers fairly. So that's what we mean by it's an outcome-focused approach. So what we're interested in is a good outcome for the customer. And that's probably a combination of principles, making sure that we have the right principles in the legislation. Sometimes it'll need rules, will require rules. But it's all about trying to embed the proper culture of treating customers fairly within a company and through each stage of the product life cycle. We did issue a discussion paper in April this year, which if members are interested, we would certainly pass on. And that introduced the concept of TCF. But really, because it's really about bringing about behavioral change in financial services companies, we do recognize that it will be a multi-year project. It's not something you're going to achieve overnight. So we will have to keep on with this project over the coming years. And it will require various elements, one of which is to make sure that from our side, the FSB, that we've given clear regulatory guidance. So we will review our regulations and so on to make sure we've given the necessary guidance. But it will also require financial institutions to do a self-assessment of their own culture and processes and procedures, and whether it embeds the fair treatment of customers. Of course, we can't only rely on companies to do the right thing. We have to make sure they do the right thing. So it's about making sure our supervisory approach is as effective as it can be, and making sure that they do that. And importantly, also, it's about visible enforcement. You have to create the right incentive structures. So if that means that we have to name and shame and put a few heads on sticks, as they say, to where there's examples of bad conduct as a deterrent and to create the right and disincentive to not treat customers fairly, then that's also part of the strategy. As I said, the discussion paper was issued for comments to industry in April 2010. The comments have come back. I guess it's reassuring that nobody in industry fundamentally disagreed with the concept that they should be treating their customers fairly, which is a good thing. But there were a lot of questions around how does the FSB intend implementing this TCF initiative, and we're working towards issuing further guidance on implementation of the initiative by the end of 2010. Chair, if I can move on to deal with the next slide as well, which is on the subject of financial inclusion or access to finance and financial sector development. Again, this is an objective very close to the heart of the FSB about making sure particularly low-income individuals have appropriate access to financial services and products. Where it is particularly relevant to the work of the FSB is in the insurance area, because appropriately there has been a lot of focus on access to banking products and the Mzansi product and about issues of access to credit and microcredit, which is all important and mostly falls in the banking sector. But it's also important that low-income customers have access to insurance, because it's one thing having the credit available so that people can develop small businesses and work their way out of the cycle of poverty. But without insurance, it's very easy for those people to be knocked back down again into that cycle. If there's an unforeseen event like a fire or a death in the family of the breadwinner in the family, so there is now also quite a bit of focus on issues of broadening access to insurance products, and this falls largely under the heading of microinsurance. And what's meant by microinsurance is insurance products appropriate to the needs of low-income customers. Much of this work around microinsurance was also in response to problems of consumer abuse due to unregistered insurance business. In particular, funeral parlors, for instance, that were doing unregistered business and not paying claims when they should be. There has been a process. There was an initial microinsurance discussion paper, I think it was 2 or 3 years back, that the National Treasury published. The FSB is now working with the National Treasury to publish a final policy position paper. I think that the Treasury tells us that should be ready by next month, which will also form the basis for dedicated legislation dealing with microinsurance, the aims of which is to reducing regulatory barriers to broadening access to insurance, but it's also about encouraging some formalization of the sector and particularly encouraging informal players who are currently outside the system of supervision and regulation to be brought into regulatory oversight. And it also recognizes the importance of coordination across various regulators and government departments in bringing about the proper enforcement of insurance in this area.
Thank you, Chair. I think by now the committee members are asking themselves, with all these things that have been said through the various presentations, what is the FSB going to do where people are in breach of all this good conduct, code of conduct, legislation, regulations, directives, and on and on. Under enforcement, Chair, members of the committee will possibly remember that initially when this enforcement concept was introduced, it was solely introduced to deal with misconduct within the investment institutions area, particularly capital markets. But this committee or your predecessors were approached to expand the responsibilities of this enforcement committee to include all areas of legislation, regulations under the FSB, so that FSB is able to deal speedily with any breach emanating from any law of the FSB and regulations. And the purpose of the enforcement committee is really to make sure that people are compensated speedily, and secondly, sanctions are administered to the those who breaches the regulations and any legislation of the FSB. Again, why this was introduced is over the years we've had an experience that the FSB would do a lot of things, come up with cases of breach and refer this to the prosecuting authority to deal with these matters. But because of the overload of cases within the NPA, cases were not heard speedily. But of course, the enforcement function at the FSB is not meant to replace the functions of the NPA. All that we're doing is to make sure that where people have lost their savings, we get that quickly back to the investor. And also where sanctions are due, we do that quickly through the enforcement committee. And this enforcement committee, we say it's the FSB one, but it is made up of independent people from the various professionals, chaired by very often by retired judges, so that parties, including the FSB, we able to go and appear in front of the investment, this enforcement committee, state our case against the perpetrators, and also afford the perpetrators an opportunity of stating their case, and of, we make our prayers there. If we succeed, remember, we there for the members, because, I mean, for investors, because investors very often can't fight their cases. We go there for them. If we succeed, compensation and sanctions are there. Good luck for the investor. If we lose, then it means we may have to take the matter to the court of law. But that is basically the tool that we have under enforcement. And to date, we've been able to, through this enforcement committee, we've been able to get back about 17 million rand back to the investors after presenting their cases through the enforcement committee. And now we're going to check. We have concluded this piece of presentation. There's another document, a separate document on consumer education, which is also a massive one. And I wonder if how Chair wants to deal, whether you want us to take questions on this first document or the second one. We are in your hands, to the Chair.
No, thanks, Mr. Tidi. What I'm going to propose is that this was, first, let me say, this was quite an elaborate presentation, quite challenging in terms of the information that required members to imbibe and engage immediately with. So I'm going to suggest that we break for 10 minutes. Let's have a leg stretch, and I think you also need some time to have water after this presentation. When I come back, we'll then deal with this presentation before we move to the consumer education program. Yeah, let's stretch our legs.
Hello.